Hi, welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm a national security analyst at the Center for American Progress. And with me today, for the first time on Bogging Heads, is Zach Bishan, a former contributor and research assistant for Andrew Sullivan's blog, The Daily Dish, and now a writer and reporter at Think Progress. Welcome, Zach.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Where are you talking to me from?
Chilmark, Massachusetts, on a very, very nice family vacation. For some reason, they're tolerating me being on the internet talking all morning. But
wonderful. Do you have a nice 4th?
I did, except that most of it was traveling. The afternoon part was fine, but being literally planes, trains, automobiles, and then boats too. Not the most convenient of 4ths. Certainly not nearly enough barbecues, but you know that.
All right, well, let's get right into our discussion here. One of the big stories that's kind of been lighting up the internet and the Twitters has been the Al Jazeera English, I'll put it in quotes, scoop on new evidence suggesting that Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the PLO and the president of the Palestinian Authority, may have been poisoned by polonium that caused his death. Now, this is, you know, this rumor was, you know, or versions of this rumor were kind of floating around from the very early days after Arafat died, all kinds of different theories, some of them involving, you know, radiation poisoning and other things. But Al Jazeera claims that it now has articles of Arafat's clothing provided to them by his widow, Suha Arafat, and that there are traces of this toxic substance on it, and some Suha Arafat and other Palestinians now have called for Arafat's body to be exhumed. What do you think of all this, Zach?
Yeah, it strikes me as incredibly dodgy, given all the evidence. And I mean, no one would ever call me a nuclear scientist or a medical doctor, you know, anything like those two things. But as far as I understand the way that polonium works, it has a very short half-life. And so major traces of the sort seen right now, right, if this was actually present at the time of Arafat's death, should have gone away by now. That is, it should have been reduced to only minor amounts of polonium poisoning. Further, Arafat's symptoms were not what one typically sees in polonium poisoning cases. To take just one example, there was no hair loss, which is pretty common as far as I understand it, in most radiation treatments and in polonium poisoning as well. That's what you saw with the Russian spy who was – well, yeah. Not spy, sorry. He was a –
right.
Yeah. That's what you saw with him, right? He had hair loss and various other symptoms that are pretty sort of typical. I mean, there's only been a small number of polonium cases that are typical of them. So this – the evidence seems really weak. And even the doctors who Al Jazeera sourced the story to weren't entirely convinced that this was conclusive evidence of poisoning.
Right, and I think that the way that the kind of conditionality of the Al Jazeera story also speaks to that they weren't entirely sure that they had the story, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, sure, something like this is going to cause a big uproar, it's going to get a lot of readers, it's going to get a lot of web hits, etc. But, yeah, I mean, even the story as written, I mean, and I was using almost a direct quote, it's like, new evidence suggests that Arafat may have been, you know, okay, fine. I think what you just said about, you know, the half-life of polonium is true, all the stuff regarding his symptoms. I mean, my question has to do with, you know, obviously people are saying that it was Israel who was responsible for this. I just am not sure what Israel had to gain from killing Arafat at that point. I mean, it seems to me that they had more to gain from keeping Arafat just as he was, isolated and largely discredited, and Israel under absolutely no pressure whatsoever to negotiate with him.
Right, and at that point, in 2004, the Second Intifada was winding down. It wasn't like Arafat was leading a significant wave of attacks in any meaningful sense on Israel, even if one believes that Arafat was in charge of or had a significant planning role in the Second Intifada, right? That's pretty hotly debated among historians. We'll move past that and just say, by 2004, that wasn't so much an issue. The security barrier was coming up and suicide attacks were on the wane. So I just I don't see what Israel would have to gain from it. Now, I've heard theories, and I'm sure you've heard them too, that it was either, if this were the case, that the speculation is that it was another faction inside Fatah, or it was someone else, some other international actor. Yeah. Certainly there were no dearth of people who disliked Arafat, but I can't see why when he was elderly and not nearly as in command of the Palestinians as he was in the past, right, that this would be considered as significant or useful, especially given the attendant risks, right? Poisoning someone of high prominence is a serious, serious risk to a country, given all the various different international rules about assassination and the general...
Right, I mean, and Israel had a very bad experience with this when they tried to assassinate Khaled Mashal in 97, I think it was. Massive embarrassment. They had to provide an antidote. So, I think it's clear that Ariel Sharon himself just hated Arafat intensely. And I'm not saying it's impossible, but again, it seems like something very reckless, first of all, and second of all, just, again, going back to my original question, I'm not sure what they had really to gain by removing Arafat. I think there's an argument to be made that Arafat was unique in, as problematic as he was, he was one of the few leaders, possibly the only leader to really, who had the sort of personal authority to unite to any extent the Palestinian factions. And I think we've seen after his passing that, the increasing division between Fatah and Hamas.
At the time, I believe Sharon was starting to... thinking about implementing the disengagement plan, right, in 2004. And so it seems totally crazy to, if your goal is to develop an orderly withdrawal from the West Bank, sorry, from Gaza, right, it seems crazy to try to kill the one person who represents a degree of order on the other side, right, and create a chaotic situation which could potentially, make things more dangerous during the withdrawal process. Right?
Well,
I don't know why Israel would plan that. It doesn't make very much sense to me.
Well, I mean, there's also the thing about the withdrawal is that, Israel notably did not coordinate that withdrawal with the Palestinian Security Services, even though Mahmoud Abbas begged Sharon to do that.
Right.
So I think that actually the way that the withdrawal was carried out actually argues against the idea that Sharon didn't want confusion and chaos. It's the way that Israel did this completely unilaterally with no coordination with the Palestinian side has always seemed to me to suggest that chaos was seen as one of the features.
Maybe, but
certainly not the amount of chaos that we got.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Israel has shown a marked preference in some foreign policy decisions for a devil you know type approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's much more comfortable in a lot of cases, or at least recently, with stability rather than change because Israel's come to recognize Islamists as a more serious threat than more secular authoritarians and has also recently begun to think that, especially we see this post-Arab Spring most clearly, but I think this is a somewhat storied tradition in Israeli foreign policy since roughly the end of Nasserism, right, of becoming increasingly skeptical of chaos and change and preferring the status quo given Israel's qualitative military advantage and the self-interested character of Arab dictators.
Right, but again, I think this goes to what Sharon was trying to accomplish with the withdrawal from Gaza. First of all, it was a very difficult... These settlements were especially difficult to defend, both, militarily and politically. And it was also, he was under increasing pressure from, you had the Arab Peace Initiative, you had the Bush administration making more overtures toward actually getting involved in a peace process, and it had to do with sort of retaking the initiative and showing him, and kind of going about something that could be called a move toward peace, in quotes, on his own terms. So I think the benefits there, in as I figure it, outweighed the downsides of, what eventually happened. Gaza. Not to say that that was an intention, but I'm saying the fact that the Israelis refused to coordinate with Abbas, even though Abbas had asked them repeatedly to do this, suggests that there was something behind that.
Well, I think it was more that they felt uncomfortable in a variety of different ways according with the Palestinians on the withdrawal plan. I mean, Sharon's mm-hmm. whole career speaks to a mistrust of the Palestinian leadership, mm-hmm. fear of leaking, yeah. not being certain that any information he gave to Abbas wouldn't end up making its way somehow to an organization that would hurt Israelis during the withdrawal process. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's necessarily evidence that they preferred chaos at the top levels so much as they had a skepticism of the ability to coordinate with the Palestinians. I think those are distinct positions.
Yeah, I'm not saying that they, you know, this was part of the plan just yeah. for Gaza to implode or fall under Hamas rule. I'm just saying what happened in Gaza afterward, though, certainly was considered. It was not the key goal of the Gaza withdrawal. I mean, I think Sharon's advisor, Dov Weisglatz, made very clear that the goal of the Gaza withdrawal was to put the peace process in formaldehyde, to give Israel the political space, you know, to decide what it wanted to do without so much pressure to negotiate.
Well, it was, but it was also because Sharon had come to recognize that the current situation was untenable, right? That Sharon made moves towards becoming much, much more understanding of the need for a two-state solution than he had in the past, and he didn't lose his distrust of the Palestinian leadership, right? So that's why the withdrawal is this mishmash, right? So
I see no evidence that Sharon embraced the need for a two-state solution.
I don't know. His public statements about the demographic threat. I think.
Right, but people use that argument. I mean, we can leave aside the illiberality of the demographic argument and maybe come back to that later.
Sure.
But, I mean, just, you know, at a very practical level, just, you know, giving up the settlements in Gaza in order to strengthen the settlements in the West Bank, I mean, I think was clearly what was going on, and we've seen that in the intervening years.
Yeah, I don't know if that was the case. I think I don't think Sharon was ready to withdraw right away. I mean, we'll never know, obviously. But at least based on my read of the way that Israeli Palestinians, especially on the right, were talking about Sharon, almost in traitor-like terms, right? And people on the left were becoming increasingly sympathetic to him after the withdrawal. And these are actual Israeli political figures who I assume actually spoke to Sharon, right, during the process. It's at least suggestive evidence that there was a real understanding that the current state of the occupation of Palestinian territories was untenable for Israel in the long term, mm-hmm. even in the West Bank too.
I think that's right. But what I'm saying is that does not, you know, accepting that does not lead you to say that Arafat or that Sharon necessarily embraced a two-state solution. I mean,
well, not in a principled sense. In a maybe or maybe not. I don't know. I don't know the content of his heart. Right. I do know that I think in a practical sense, he recognized a need for some type of division and the fact that Israel couldn't continue to control the West Bank and Gaza, and like add those things up and it results in an implicit acceptance of something like the two-state solution.
No, I think that's, you know, that's a common view, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, I think, you know, the change in Sharon's views is notable, but it also speaks to how extreme he was at the start. So, you know, sure, where he ended up was substantially to the left of where he started. But, you know, consider where he started. But as to the view of, you know, ending the occupation, I think, you know, it's not inconsistent with what you hear from a lot of Likud figures like Bogi Yalon and Benny Begin, who say, yes, the occupation is bad. Let's try to give the Palestinians some rights. But, you know, this idea of a Palestinian state is just not going to happen.
But, of course, Sharon broke with Likud, though. That was how Kadima was created, right? That was the whole point of Kadima.
A fair point. But yeah. I'm saying, I mean, I can see the consistency with what Sharon was saying with what these other figures of the Israeli right continue to say.
Yeah. Yeah, no,
he broke with them. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's personal. That's totally a plausible explanation. I think it's somewhat hard to parse these two, right, because we're getting down to a very fine-grained difference in interpretation of what Sharon was going about, and there's, I think, a fair amount of evidence could be used to support either view. I mean, my gut feeling is that the creation of Kadima is pretty strong evidence that there was some difference between him and the sort of Likud attitudes that you're describing right now.
On the Gaza withdrawal, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. But getting back to the Arafat point, I mean,
right.
So what happens now? I mean, they dig up Arafat's body, they try to find traces of this radiation on him. I mean, I don't know. It just seems it's one of these stories that I really have a hard time getting worked up about. you know?
Yeah.
It really just seems to have come out of nowhere, and I thought we'd, you know, listen, when Arafat passed away, I was in grad school, and I remember hearing just numerous conspiracy theories, you know, even from professors, some of whom, you know, who claimed, you know, there was my one Palestinian professor who had high contacts within the PA, and my other Israeli professor who had it on the highest authority that Arafat had died of AIDS, you know, so these kind of rumors have been flying around from the very beginning. So this one coming up now, it just seems very strange. So it leads me to wonder, you know, who benefits now within the sort of Palestinian establishment. Is this kind of an internal Fatah thing? I don't know.
It's extremely worrying in that sense, right? Because Fatah right now is facing somewhat of a crisis of authority, given the lack of progress over the past 4 years in moving towards any sort of meaningful two-state agreement. And even Fayyad recently, as quoted in a recent New York Times article, admitted that they were losing the argument internally, right? The sort of pro-reconciliation compromise faction inside Fatah. And so for some news that many Palestinians could potentially interpret as evidence of Israel's thoroughgoing hostility to the Palestinian national cause, right, any news like that could be, to borrow a metaphor from an Israeli security official, could be a spark in the tinderbox or gas chamber. I forget the exact metaphor, but, you know, things could go real badly on the slightest of pretexts in the status quo, especially given the constant sort of low-level conflicts that have been going on in the West Bank persistently for a while. So that's why this kind of reporting and speculation is a little bit scary and kind of dangerous. And it's not to say that, you know, good reporters shouldn't report what they find, right? You should obviously report what you find, but rather the after effects of this particular report to me could be potentially very worrying.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And no, I agree with you right down the line there. But again, going back to the way that this Al Jazeera story was written, it says to me that they are quite aware that the evidence that they're working on is not, you know, rock solid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I agree. It was, but so. it also sort of slights it a little bit in that sense, right? It has those qualifiers that you described at the beginning of our conversation, but then it goes on to assert, like, one of the subleads inside the piece, a subhead inside the piece, was something like, it was a crime. And that's not, in quotation marks, I think someone said that, someone in Arafat's family possibly, right? It's, when you title things like that, it makes the conclusion sound much more robust than they are if you read the fine-grained points in the article, as you did write, and makes it sound much more conclusive than it was, which is, again gets back to the point about it being interpreted in a deleterious sense.
All right, let's move over to Iran for a few minutes here.
Sure.
We've had the, you know, a new set of stringent sanctions going into effect July 1st, sanctions on the Iran Central Bank, European embargo of Iranian oil. So the pressure is increased. Iran seems no more likely to relent. The last round of talks in Moscow, well, I wouldn't call them a complete failure, were certainly not a success. We had a technical talks, I think, on Tuesday, in Istanbul, like lower-level technical talks about the possibility of a compromise. Where do you think the talks are at? Where do you think it's going?
I don't know. The early dismissal of the Wednesday meeting was not a good sign. And it fits this continual pattern that we've seen recently in the Iran negotiations of chat for a little bit, no conclusions between either sides, everybody gives statements that are, like, kind of positive but don't really contain any real content, and then we say we're going to meet again later. And there never appear to be any meaningful breakthroughs, and it just seems to go around in circles over and over again, continually getting back to the same basic issues. And so I don't know about you, but I haven't seen any real meaningful progress in the negotiations, which is bad, right? I'm not saying that like it's a yay, now we get the bomb time thing. This is bad because it could potentially lead to much worse solutions for both for Americans, Israelis, and Iranians, and all other parties concerned, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I agree. Yeah, no breakthrough, and it does seem, you know, I think there's been, you know, Iran at the outset in the first Istanbul talks, you know, a few months ago, I think there was a lot of relief and optimism in that Iran seemed ready and willing to engage on the nuclear question in a way that they had not previously.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that sort of dissipated when it became clear that they were going to continue to insist on their right to enrich at the exclusion of all else, and the United States and its partners, but, you know, with the United States sort of pushing, we're going to insist on closing Fordo, on shipping out the uranium. So it seemed like there was a little bit of space for an agreement at the very beginning. It seems much less so now, but I think, interestingly, all the sides seem committed to the idea that it's important to keep talking. I'm not entirely sure what to make of that, but I do, you know, like Churchill said, jaw-jaw is better than war-war, and
sure.
I agree with that. Obviously, you have the Israeli concerns that as we talk, Iran continues to enrich, but of course, even if we weren't talking, Iran continues to enrich, which gets to the point, okay, we've got these sanctions, and, you know, if no one, I don't think anyone really doubted that sanctions such as these, and even previous sanctions, could cause considerable economic pain to Iran and to Iranians. But the question is always, okay, at what point does that pain translate into a change in behavior or a greater willingness to make concessions on Iran's part? And the answer is no one really knows.
Right. And it depends on your theory about why the Iranian government wants to acquire nuclear weapons so badly. Right. And I wonder if on every potential theory, the incentives to get the nuclear weapons outweighs the however much pain could be inflicted by the sanctions.
Right.
So, like, one theory is they want it for self-defense. They want to be invaded by the United States. In that case, who cares about sanctions, right? Because you're worried about an existential threat that is a U.S. invasion, right? Second, they want it because they want to use it as a shield to project power regionally. This, I think, is the theory that's, like, most amenable, I think, to a sanctions pressure type thing, because the sanctions are, as Dan Dresner noted recently in a pretty interesting little blog post, limiting their ability to project power regionally, because having a bad economy means you can't build up your military all that effectively.
Or you can't transfer that money to other proxies.
Yeah, exactly, right? And the third one is they want it because they're religious fanatics. And if that one's the case, then clearly sanctions aren't going to work because, you know, they want it because they're religious fanatics. So the success of the sanctions, I guess there's option four, right? The sanctions are going to lead to regime change. But I don't know if there's ever been an actual example of a people rising up as a consequence of external economic sanctions. Now, obviously, there are for people rising up because of bad economic conditions. But I don't know if the sanctions themselves are going to be able to – well, first of all, if they ever have done this before. Or second, in Iran, right on the heels of the 2009 protest movement, whether any amount of sanctions are going to be enough to revitalize that momentum, which seemed to me to be very internally driven, right? It was about denial of our democratic rights as Iranians, and that foreign engagement might not have been all that helpful, right? And probably,
right. I mean, that's been my view too. I mean, I've constantly returned to that question of President Obama's, you know, statements during the June 2009 uprising, because it seemed, I mean, this is something that, I mean, it seems like it's a point that conservatives continue to try to score on him, say, oh, you know, when people rose up in Iran and we have an opportunity to change the Iranian government, Obama didn't take it. I just think that's just complete nonsense. I mean, I have never seen anyone describe a plausible scenario in which President Obama makes more speeches and more stronger speeches in support of the demonstrators, and then we get a new Iranian government.
Right.
I mean, I think we can argue about whether he should have spoken out more strongly. I think he made a number of statements with regard to counting their votes and nonviolence and respecting human rights. But again, I recognize that an argument to be made that he should have spoken out more strongly, but just the idea that we could have radically changed the game by more speeches, I just find to be completely stupid.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't make any sense. You have to, like, whenever someone tries to explain to you a pathway as to how you're going to change something in international politics. You need to explain the actual causal logic behind it. Right? So what is it about speeches, specifically, that was going to make the Green Movement more effective or scare the Iranian government? Or what was it? Right? You can't just say Obama should speak out in favor of freedom because when you speak out in favor of freedom, therefore more freedom. Right? It doesn't work that way. Otherwise, I would be standing on a soapbox at every street corner in every city yelling freedom really loudly. And I don't think being president gives you magic speech powers, right? It really, you have to show the causal pathway. And I've never seen one in these accounts of the Green Movement.
Yeah. I know, and I've actually, it's funny because, I mean, there is, I don't know, I mean, this is kind of, I had a chance to speak to a congressional aide of a congressperson who makes these kinds of criticisms all the time. Mm-hmm. And I asked, you know, I asked him to explain to me, just what I just asked just now. Okay, explain to me the logic, you know, explain to me how this happens. Okay, explain to me how making more stronger speeches in favor of the protesters creates a better outcome. And of course he couldn't. It was just kind of like this generalized, like, oh, well, we know from the Arab Spring that, you know, people power, blah, blah, blah. And it's just kind of like this generalized, soft-headed idea that, oh, something happens and then we have a better Iran. But it's just, it's amazing to me how often this claim is repeated.
Right. Now, I think the interesting question in contemporary events now is to what extent sanctioning and the sort of sanctions regime is falling prey to the same sort of logic. There's pressure, we do something, doing something will lead to good changes.
Right.
And I think that the most plausible pathway is that they is to argue that the sanctions are having some effect, sanctions combined with sabotage, i.e. Stuxnet flame, that sanctions and sabotage are having some effect of slowing down the nuclear program, and that the longer that you slow the nuclear program down, the greater a likelihood you have of getting an Iranian leadership at one point that's more likely to compromise, even if the current one isn't. And I think that's probably the most plausible case for the current sanctions regime. I don't know if you feel the same way, but that's my thought in any event.
Right. I don't know. Should we move to Mitt Romney and his upcoming trip to Israel?
Yes, we shall.
Announced earlier this week, presidential candidate, former Governor Mitt Romney, will be traveling to Israel. Now, the thing that occurred to me, and this is funny because it occurred to Jeffrey Goldberg as well, is that this really suggests that Israel will not be attacking Iran anytime soon. Romney going, do you see what I'm saying there?
Yeah, but it's assumptive of them, of Mitt Romney sort of, well, I guess no, it's not really, right? If the Israelis agreed to it, then that would suggest they don't want to have an Iran war while Mitt Romney's there. Maybe.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting anything, weird is going on. I'm just saying the way it looks is, the way it would look is enough to prevent, you know, at least for the next couple months, Israel from attacking Iran. I think that's pretty interesting. But as to the intentions here, you know, Mitt Romney has clearly made the relationship with Israel a key part of his foreign policy platform. It ties into the Iran issue, obviously, which is another big issue he's spoken on. As to the goal here, yeah, it seems to me clearly to kind of draw this distinction about how much of a better friend to Israel Mitt Romney would be. But it's also, it seems to me, a way to kind of shore up his right-wing Christian evangelical base for whom the U.S.-Israel relationship is a very important point.
Yeah. I think that this trip, I agree with you, especially on that evangelical point, and I think you can extend it, right? I think the trip to Israel, which is also, by the way, part of a broader, it seems like, broader foreign mm-hmm. tour, right? He wants to go to Germany, he wants to go to Poland, and I believe the
right.
UK
I think,
as well.
Right. I think subsequently it was announced that we're adding a bunch of other countries to this trip.
Right.
I'm not sure if that was the plan from the very beginning. I just don't remember it being all announced at once. Maybe I'm wrong.
No. Israel came first and then the other two, the announcements. And it's interesting, by the way, the announcements of the other trips came after there's been a spate of stories about disarray in Romney's foreign policy team and about significant internal divisions and a lack of access to the candidate or a lack of prioritization of their issues inside the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Announcing this trip directly after those stories went to press, at least to me, is suggestive, I think, of the broader intention here, which is that it's an elite signaling mechanism. It's not that Romney thinks he's going to win the campaign on foreign policy or on making trips like this, or even that it's going to be a significant issue, right? The Romney campaign is all about the economy. It's that he wants to get elite Republicans and some grassroots Republicans who are high information voters on board on his campaign, who he thinks might not be totally interested in him. So take evangelicals, right? His approval rating has spiked among evangelicals since he won the nomination, thus allaying some fears that a Mormon might not be able to get evangelical support.
Yeah.
But it's not clear that high approval ratings translate into enthusiasm and turnout and so on. So symbolic gestures like these, it seems to me, are designed to get that kind of supporter who could be a high-intensity supporter on board.
Mm-hmm.
And the trips to other elites – trips to other countries, like Poland is a great example here, because the standard Republican talking point against the Obama administration, they've abandoned our allies, most typically Israel and Poland. And so the trip to Poland is supposed to reassure GOP foreign policy elites, who might be a little bit nervous about his lack of committal statements on this issue, that they should get on board, right? That he's going to agree with them, he's going to take a similar policy line as they do, etc.
Yeah. No, that sounds right. So it's kind of like Bush's message, I care. It's Romney's message, I care about foreign policy.
Exactly, right? And it takes a limited amount of time and isn't a big distraction from his campaign, I think.
Right.
That's my read here.
So I wonder if he'll be having, like, massive rallies in these countries like Obama did on his big European tour. Somehow I doubt it.
Yeah, I don't get the European love for Mitt somehow. Don't see it.
Yeah. That's a point in his favor for his base. So.
That's true. Except in Eastern Europe.
He'll be running ads about how much the Europeans don't like him.
Hasn't that been every Republican campaign for the past 12 years? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, again, just not sure what else to say about the trip to Israel. It'll be really interesting to see who he meets with and how that's reported.
Well, it's interesting. I did hear he was meeting with both the government and the opposition.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
While he was there. And the campaign did also say they try to limit criticism of Obama from foreign countries. It'd be interesting to see if they stick with that, because I do remember strongly that George W. Bush critique of Obama somewhat failed, but nonetheless.
Oh, yeah.
In 2008.
Right. I think not by name, but definitely very clearly criticizing his idea about talking to Iran as appeasement, which is another kind of misnomer that's always bothered me. I mean, it's a complete misunderstanding of what appeasement actually is.
Which means giving them things as opposed to, you know, just
right.
talking with them.
Not just talking. But I guess the assumption is that sitting down with America is such a huge legitimacy granting exercise that in itself represents appeasement. I think that's the basic assumption. I find it really silly, but just trying to understand where that comes from.
Right. I think that's the idea. I mean, we are awesome. Don't get me wrong.
I'm a believer in American awesomeness. But any last words here? Any last ideas to leave me with, leave our audience with?
Audience. Let's see. Be skeptical about reports that you hear. I guess, given that's been sort of the running theme of this conversation, right? Be skeptical about reports that Arafat has been poisoned. Be skeptical about whether or not the reports that sanctions are working and the talks are going anywhere are all that true. And then be skeptical about the stated intentions behind Romney's foreign policy trip, that it might be more complicated or a little bit more below the surface than you'd think. I mean, if there's one unifying theme, that's what I'm drawing out of this conversation.
That's an excellent summation, Zach. Thanks so much for doing this. I hope we can do it again.
I would love to.